Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Chris Brennan from Breakdown the Book Group in Northeast Philadelphia.
Hi, everybody. My name is Chris Brennan. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'd like to thank Jeff or anyone who was involved in asking me to come out and speak. I question your judgment, but other than that, it's an honor and a pleasure to speak at an AA meeting. We stopped at Five Guys on the way over, so if I got any ketchup or anything hanging off me, just bear with us. Say hi to my friends from Philadelphia that drove up with me over there. Last time we were out, I didn't acknowledge them, and I got a lot of trouble for that. I'll give you the particulars. My sobriety date's March 2nd, 1994. My home group is called Break Down the Book. It's a one paragraph at a time, big book study, Northeast Philadelphia, Holy Family University, every Friday night at 7 o'clock. If you're ever in the area, please visit. We'd love to have you. As you can tell by the name of that, that's kind of what we do. We break down the book, one sentence, one paragraph at a time, on the theory that the big book is a textbook. I believe there's two kinds of people in AA, pretty much. Those who the big book is a book written by our founders, just a novel to read when you're tired or something like that, kind of optional, and those who believe it's a manual for life full of directions that's meant to be studied, etc. And I fall into that category. Wasn't always that way. I didn't walk into Alcoholics Anonymous 17 years ago and pick up a big book. If I walked into an AA meeting my first year sober, believe me, it was strictly by accident. If I walked in and seen books on the table, we'd literally be like, nah, it just didn't look like fun. You know what I mean? I like to have fun, and it just didn't appeal to me at all. I got sober in a clubhouse in Northeast Philadelphia called Stepping Stones. Many of you may know where that is at. And I owe my life to those guys that were there, guys like Bud R. and some of the old-timers that were hanging out in there when I got there. I was born and raised in Southwest Philadelphia, 57th and Elmwood, St. Mary's of Częstochowa Grade School. Although I got sent there because the bigger school was too filled at the time. West Catholic High School. I come from a good family. I wish I had a horror story to tell you about my family. I could embellish if you like, but I got two good parents, as far as I know, that loved me. Two older sisters that always loved me. I'm the only one in the family that suffers from this disease, as far as we could tell. My father was no stranger to a cocktail. He drank and smoked his whole life. He just died in last January at 87 years old, outlived everybody in the family. So go figure that one out. He was a Marine, and that's what I was going to do growing up. I can remember as a kid, what the whole attitude was, when you're in Paris Island, you'll like it. Whether that was lima beans or whatever it was, that was kind of his attitude. He had played some minor league baseball, and to me, my hero in life, smartest guy I ever met in my life, completely because he read everything. He was an obsessive reader, and that's how he educated himself. I mean, he went to school and all that, 12 years of school, but he just was a big reader, and he tried to instill that in me so bad, and I just rebelled at it because I'm the kind of guy, I'm not a reader. And I took that attitude through life. I probably, if I read one or two books completely through by the time I made it to AA at age 33, that would be a stretch. And I just didn't, you know, it just didn't appeal to me. And I had kind of always had that attitude. And he used to look at me and go, well, you can read, can't you? We did teach you to read, right? It's not a matter of that. And it was more, I just thought, you know what I mean? I guess as a kid, whatever, you rebel at everything. And I paid the price for that in life because I never learned past a certain extent. Because I think, I mean, I'm an obsessive reader today is the point. Like Dr. Bob says, he had to train himself to read spiritual material an hour a day. And I had to train myself to do it. But for the last number of years, I love it. We're on the other end with it now. We're studying Dr. Bob's reading list, guys like Emmett Fox and Oswald Chambers and James Allen and those guys. And we just love it. And I believe part of step 11, that spiritual journey, God working through me to you, is all that stuff is all about. To me, it's all AA at a certain point is all about. The information doesn't do me any good, by the way. I can read spiritual stuff. Dr. Bob had a great quote when he met Bill Wilson years ago. He said, when you treat spirituality like a sponge, it doesn't exist. When you study the books intellectually, whether that be the big book or the Bible or whatever it is you're reading, and you just try to study it and doing it, it has no life, right? The only time this stuff that I've started reading and studying has any life is when I read it and talk to somebody about it. Yo, come here. And I talk to one of my guys, whether it's in person, at a meeting, on the phone. Look at this. And we have a discussion, and something comes alive about it. I can read the same thing and go, wow, and then get on the road and give you the finger or whatever and chase you down there. It evaporates real quickly. It has no life. And growing up down there, I don't know anything that really stands out. It was your basic Irish Catholic row house Philadelphia neighborhood, rocky, very racially divided in the 70s when I was just coming along. The only thing I really remember growing up, the only really goal I ever had in life was to hang out with the older guys on the corner and be old enough to hang out on the corner. That's the only thing that drove me. And I thought of myself as a smart kid. As a matter of fact, I thought of myself as pretty much a genius, if you ask me. But I never really, I don't know if I wasn't pushed or whatever. The kids I was hanging out with back then, nobody really went to college. If you did, you were a little bit of a weirdo, and we didn't hang out with you. But I just remember at a certain age, no more ball, no more this, no more that. I just wanted to hang out. And I can't tell you the exact day, but one of my first drinks, you're talking about a shy kid, maybe 16, 17 years old, sometime around 1976. And it was about that time I was going to become a junior in high school. I hadn't done really much at all up to that point in my life. As a kid, I remember alcohol is being in a house, and I can associate it. Adults get together, they drink, fun. Yeah, I know, there's fighting and all after that sometimes, but it just seemed like a good time, and that really appealed to me. And I can remember as a kid them giving us like whiskey and milk if we had a toothache or couldn't sleep or something like that. And so I always remember alcohol being around. And, we were no stranger to it. My mother rarely ever drank at all. My father loved his scotch. He was no stranger to that. But he worked 40-year shift work at an oil refinery, never missed a day's work that I'm aware of, and provided for us. And, you know, does that make you alcoholic? I don't think so. When I came out of rehab in 1994 and started looking at the big book a little bit, I was like, Dad, you know, you should live. He said, I'm not one of you guys. He didn't say it that nicely. He kind of told me where I could put that book, right? He said, I'm not one of you guys. And then when I started actually not reading it, but studying it, and where it talks about the difference between a heavy drinker and a real alcoholic, I had to go back to him and apologize. I said, you know what? According to the definition, you're not. Given a sufficient reason, a warning, the doctor said, if you have another drink, you're going to die. He never drank again for about 18 years. And I had to take him to the hospital one night, and he was told, I've been giving them warnings my whole life. By the time I got to the car, it's left me. Maybe I'm just very immature, which is certainly possible, but just warnings like that from people never did anything to me. I always blew it off and thought, I got it this time. I can fix it. I can handle this. And got out of high school in 1978, and I accidentally got a job at a place called the Philadelphia Stock Exchange. Bunch of bozos from the neighborhood. We went down, and they put a tie on us, and we were running around with those brightly colored jackets, checking off numbers off a sheet of paper, and you talk about a breeding ground for alcoholism and other things. Not only was it accepted, it was encouraged. Everybody drank. I made a name for myself as a new kid on the block that maybe could do my job during the day, but really where I excelled is I could take you out. We all had expense accounts at 20 years old. I mean, we were ruined at 20, 21 years old. Way too much money, living in Center City, Philadelphia, eating at the finest restaurants every night. I mean, I'm paying the price at 50 years old now for all that stuff. I never had any respect for money, never learned how to appreciate it or any of that. And it was just, we were just flying through life. And, I mean, it was a lot of fun, don't get me wrong. I feel sorry for people who get to the podium and it's almost like they never had a day of fun in their life. I had a lot of fun, I think. Most of it is hearsay. I mean, I can't really be sure. I'm not real clear on a lot of stuff, but I'm pretty sure that some of it had to be fun. And we did a lot of drinking from morning all through the day, at night, take customers out, we called it. It was really very little business related. And, I mean, you just talk about a kid in a candy store. About 5 years into that, I had a title. I was in my early 20s. Bill Wilson talks about in his story he had arrived. The funny thing is I'm sitting in rehab, and I remember I had the attitude, the hell am I going to learn from a book? People were trying to get me to look at the big book. And the man who was to become my sponsor, who worked in there, and he knew a little bit about me, he goes, Chris, you're a moron. Do you realize he was a stockbroker? Like, because I'm thinking, what am I going to... And I started reading Bill's story, and it was like very close to my own story. So that's just one of the many paradoxes for me in AA. But my first embarrassment from drinking, although I didn't attribute it to drinking, I got in some legal trouble down there, and I got a phone call, which was to become normal over the next course of the next 5-6 years, and it went something like this: Chris, we love you, but we have to let you go. And I never, I was never the kind of guy that would get mad over that. I thought the world revolved around me and everything would stop. So I just thought, don't worry about it. It's my own fault. I'll go work for somebody else. To hell with you. No big deal. And we always had that attitude. I did what I always do. We regrouped. We went to Fort Lauderdale. Some friends of mine had been working down there sometime by then at a place called the Parrot Lounge right on the beach in Fort Lauderdale. And that's where I go to regroup. I don't know what you do, but you give me a pen and a copybook, I'll fix my life in 10 minutes. I'll start writing stuff down. I mean, I never follow through with it, but you give me a couple drinks and a pen, and I can fix anything. Unfortunately, I always connected my happiness with monetary means, and really there's no part for that in the spiritual world. So that's why I was kind of off base in life. And I was living by a formula that was bound to kill me sooner or later, but I didn't know that as a young kid. By the end of the decade of the 1980s, I'll say in passing, I picked up a habit with another substance, the poppy, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. If you suffer from any kind of problem like that, I hope you can stand up here and say that someday and actually mean it, because it got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous maybe a little before my time. Who knows? Maybe I'd have never got here. I wasn't on course to study any spiritual writings when I was when I was 30 years old. You know what I mean? I would put a suit on in the morning, go to work, have to duck bookies and this and that, beg, borrow, steal. And this is on the floor of the stock exchange. By this time, I just was burning through people and just ruined my reputation, my friendships. You know how it goes. And you do what you got to do. And eventually, I got the call again, and I just knew something was different this time. And sometime around April of 1990, they said to leave again and don't bother coming back. And I vaguely sensed they meant it this time. There was something a little different about it. And I did what all heroes do at 30 years old. I moved in with Mom and Dad. Shortly after that, my mother was diagnosed with cancer. And in my head, I thought, well, thank God I'm here for her. But I did a lot of things I'm not proud of. Things I won't get into to my father, my mother, as I was living with them. Because I thought I was only hurting myself. It's no big deal. Most of it was just financially related things. And I'm really not hurting anybody. She eventually passed away from it, so it was just me and my dad, the Marine. And he was in his 70s by now and just disgruntled with me. I had two older sisters that lived close by. And I had lost the ability to work altogether by this time. I became pretty much a professional thief. These young guys taught me how you make money. I was naive. I was like, how do you guys get money? I know you're not working. You're hanging out with me all day. What do you do for money? And they said, well, we steal. What do you think we do? And I was really naive to it. I'm like, what are you talking about? Steal what? And they introduced me to that whole underworld. And I became a thief. I grew up with morals. I'm not a bad kid. First time I stole, it bothered me. Second time, not so much. Fifth time, no big deal. I've stolen everything from the going into the super. Now, you can picture me in my head. I'm a stockbroker with maybe a cut of beef in my pants, bleeding down my leg, right? Because that's just some of the things you do. I specialize in the music business. We would just movies and CDs, and we would sell them. And that, the downside of that is I would get locked up a couple times a month. That just went with the game. And so by the time I ended up in rehab at age 33 years old, I had 35 retail theft convictions. You name it. It doesn't look good on a resume to this day. I'm in the securities business again, so I'm living proof that you can deal with stuff like that. But it's still, I've been sober 17 years. To this day, I still get questions about things, and people want to see proof of some things and explain some things. I sponsor my guys the way I was sponsored, to not to try to hide from it, to hold your head up in an interview and say, if you look at me on paper, you'll run out of this room. But I'm sober now. I can explain it. If you're into that, I'm your man. If not, I understand completely. And I've had so many more people be impressed by that than the jitterbugs that say, does that say convicted or as if, you know, as you're filling out the application. You know, the conventional mindset would be, get the job first. Tell them about that later. And I've seen guys pulled out of their job embarrassingly in front of people. I don't do it that way. My sponsor taught me, guilty will explain on interview. Pretty simple. That's the best way to go about it. And it's the most truthful way. Woke up one day, I don't know why. I know in AA people call it a moment of clarity. I don't know that I've ever had a moment of clarity. I believe God interceded in my life, and for a split time, I don't know how long it would have lasted, let me see me for me. And I woke up and I asked my family, my father, and then my sisters for help. I don't know what kind of help I needed. I'd never heard of AA. Rehab sounded like loser. Halfway house, I don't think so. Do you know who I am? Right? Just let me get my stuff together and I'll be okay. Let me get properly funded and I'll be fine. And they said, my sister said, we got you on a waiting list. It's a 28-day inpatient program called Riverside House in Northeast Philadelphia. It's not there anymore. And I remember thinking, 28 days? What the hell am I going to do for 28 days somewhere? I mean, that seems awful extreme. Just give me a week or two, let me get a job, and I'll get myself together. And that was the attitude I always had in life. Went into that rehab, wasn't real happy about it. My sobriety date coincides with the night I went in there. So as you can see, I didn't really go in there to get sober. I packed as if I was going on a cruise. And the man that did the search of my bags that night was the man that would become my sponsor. It was a guy that I think you're going to have to meet in AA. I don't mean meet him. I mean meet a person, a man or a woman, whatever applies, that you just believe. And there's something about them that you're attracted to. And he was just a normal neighborhood guy, and there was something about him that I believed when he talked about the steps or things of that nature. He did step lectures in rehab, made it sound so simple. I just sat there thinking it cannot be this easy. Not that it was easy, but this simple. I remember thinking, you're telling me, Bob, if I just do this, this, and this, I'll be okay. Yeah. And then I would go back to thinking, which you don't want to do if you're an alcoholic. The whole book is about getting away from your thinking. You really don't. That thing between your ears, that voice, that brain, that ego is not your friend. It will work against you even when you're sober, and it will try to kill you if you let it. So don't entertain it too much. Most spiritual books, AA included, everything is about self-abandonment, really, if you think about it. I know in AA we love to call it a self-help program, but it's really not. It's a self-abandonment program. A friend of mine, as a joke, always hears me say that. He went into Barnes & Noble the other day, and he asked a young girl to point him to the self-abandonment section. She said, we don't have one. And she pointed them to the self-help books. But that's the conventional mindset in AA, that I can help me. If you're going to go into that same brain that got you here, you're not going to do too well. I think I always butcher it, but it's probably Einstein that said you can't solve a problem with the mind that created it, the same level of consciousness. So don't go into your own mind that brought you in here to fix yourself. Your help has got to come from outside of you. We call it a higher power. Eventually, probably call it God, a God of your understanding, etc. Choose your own. I mean, we basically give it to you. It's a, you know, if anybody's struggling with the idea of a higher power or God, we're letting you make it up. What the hell are you struggling with? You know what I mean? How could you possibly? We're letting you choose your own conception. We basically spot you, God, in here, and we still struggle with it. I don't know, man. I'm really having a change it. You ready? It's that simple. You see, it really doesn't matter because as you go through these steps, if you ever will, actually take these steps, right? Which is the only thing that matters, taking the steps. I love to talk about them as much as the next guy. I love to study them. But it's all meaningless in the big picture. The only thing that matters is taking them. It's like eating. We call it a textbook. It's really, if you think about it, the big book is really nothing more than a cookbook. It's a bunch of recipes in there. And when I get hungry, I don't say, "Hun, let me see the cookbook." I don't read recipes. If I don't make one of them, I'll die from starvation. It's the same thing with the book. If you don't make those things come true in your life, you're going to die in here. And that's what we're into, studying that book and doing what it says. I spent my first year in AA, and I would not. I know we love to say in AA, I share my experience. And, it's my. I don't believe that. I was taught to share AA's experience. I'm an idiot. My sponsor said, forget about your experience. First of all, it was wrong. A year sober, if you asked me what step I was on, I'd give you the old fallback, I'm working the first three, which means I have no idea what you're talking about. Because if you understand the literature, that is a physical impossibility to be working the first three. So if you think you're slick saying that, it's a red flag that you don't know what you're talking about in here. And I hope someday you'll understand what that means. Or I would say, if you went to the like really higher number steps, like six or seven like that, I would say, I'm not at that step yet. And I remember about a year sober, and this is one of the moments I can look back on and just remember. About a year sober, I had somebody asked me to speak. I don't know what it was, a step meeting, whatever. And it was one of the higher numbered steps. Probably might have even had double digits. I'm not sure. But I remember talking to my sponsor, which was rare. We didn't talk a lot. He was okay with that, and so was I. Because he didn't care how I was doing. He never asked. He just said, who are you helping? Where are you at with those steps? Because he knew if I wasn't doing that, the rest was all BS anyway. So he never led me to this day, 17 years later, still hasn't asked how I'm doing. I don't think he cares. I really do. I don't think he cares. And I really don't think he cares. He understands that. And I made the statement to him to the effect of, I'm not at that step yet, Bob. And he asked me a question that I never forgot, and it stopped me in my tracks for a bright guy like me. And if you suffer from any kind of intellectual whatever we feel for you, he said, why not? Dead silence. I don't know. Is it a mental block? I don't know. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I just couldn't. I don't know. He said, you seem like a bright guy. I hear you talking about yourself a lot at meetings and all this. You know what I mean? What's the problem here? And it was just like almost wanted to jump through him and just like take this off of him. I don't know. At about the same time, friends of mine had heard a speaker at a conference, a guy, Bob O., I'll never forget him. He talked about a group out of Minnesota, the Golden Slippers, seven guys from AA that couldn't stay sober. And they come up with this novel idea. They were going to open the book and open it up and do what it said, and none of them ever drank again. They weren't going to intellectualize it. They weren't going to talk about it. When it said pray, they were going to pray. When it said write, they were going to write. None of them ever drank again. These guys were so blown away with it, they wanted to start a big book study. Joe and Charlie, the tape meetings and all, were coming around the same time. So that kind of worked well. But we started doing it maybe 16 years ago at somebody's house, and for the last 16 years straight, at least three times a week, many times more, I've been studying one subject for 16 years straight, numerous times a week. What does that make me? If I went to school for that, they'd probably give me some kind of doctorate to hang on my wall. Now, you want to say I have a doctorate in alcoholism? Okay. But it doesn't do me any good. The only thing it helps me is teach you. I'd be glad to give it to you because it doesn't do me any good if I try to keep it. And that's the way that works. And then eventually getting to step two, the teaching part of it. About the same time, I got together with the same sponsor, and we formally went through what we call the 12 steps. I had to admit it for a year. I was an alcoholic. I didn't really believe it. My name is Chris Brennan. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, drug addict, I'll give you, because I kind of thought that carried a little more weight. But alcoholic, I mean, I don't even drink that much. I remember an old-timer said, kid, sounds like you did drugs alcoholically. And that hit me. That hit me like a ton of bricks. And then we started using another book that goes great with the big book, Webster's Dictionary. And when we were reading the doctor's opinion, Silkworth talked about an abnormal reaction that people like us get when we drink alcohol. He called it an allergy. You look up the definition of allergy, you know what it says? Abnormal reaction to any substance. We looked up abnormal, you know what it says? Not in the majority. 1 out of 10 gets a certain effect, which means 9 out of 10 get a different effect. But you have to know what that is in order to know what to compare it to. Well, I'll let you be the judge. 9 out of 10 people that drink alcohol get a slightly tipsy, out of control feeling. They don't like it. They do not like feeling that way. If you try to get them to take another one, you'll get an answer like, "Ooh, no thank you. Still feel that last one. Driving. Got to go to work tomorrow." Something like that. Right? 90% of the world, they tell me, gets that effect. 1 out of 10, 10%, by definition allergic, get a different reaction. They get an in control, let's go do something, screw work, I quit. You know what I mean? Give me the keys, I'll drive. That kind of reaction, right? It changes my perception of reality. Nothing really changes, but everything looks completely different. You take this shy kid that couldn't talk to girls, all of a sudden I can ask a girl to my junior prom, senior prom, I can sing, I can dance, I can come out and play. When alcohol does that for you, it's pretty fun in the beginning, but it's not the proper reaction, they told me. That's eventually going to turn around and kill you. Bill Wilson says, like a boomerang, it'll come back and get you. Right? Well, that's the effect. I don't know about you. When that was explained to me, I'm like, wow. Well, if that's easy for you to relate to, of course it is. But the downside of that is it means you're alcoholic, and you better take these other 11 steps. See, when you understand step one properly, it's a death sentence. You're basically hopeless. The other 11 steps become mandatory. You'd be crazy not to take them. But if you don't understand step one, the other 11 steps are optional. They're just comforting ideals. Oh, yeah, I could agree with turning your will over or making amends. Have you done it? No, but I'm going. Yeah, I'm going to get to it. And they just become comforting ideals that the worst thing you can do is sit in AA and intellectually agree with. That'll kill you, in my experience. You sit in AA and start agreeing with the 12 steps, that's a danger sign, right? The only thing that matters in here is taking the 12 steps. Once you start intellectually agreeing with them, your ego will never let you take them because the ego wants no parts of them. The other part, if alcoholism was just a physical disease, right, phenomenon of craving, once I take a drink, something happens, right? If there was only physical, the solution would be simple. Just don't drink, right? Welcome to AA 101. Just don't drink. Right? Unfortunately, the whole rest of the book talks about the mental side of it, and that's not an option for people like us. We don't have a just don't drink option. Right? Page 24, in the doctor's opinion, Silkworth talks about we're restless, irritable, discontented, emotionally out of whack. And unless I can get comfortable, the only way I know is spiritual means. If I don't get comfortable somehow, when I'm uncomfortable, my mind subconsciously, don't try to prevent it, you don't even know what's going on, will start seeking relief. And it's not a lie. We talk about in AA, don't believe the lie. It's not a lie. It's a delusion. It looks real. Your mind will paint a picture and something like, you're not going to get crazy, Chris. You're just going to do this. A hard lemonade. Can that hurt you? Really, relax. And it's not that you believe a lie. It's that it's delusional and it looks. That's why willpower doesn't come into play. Because willpower only comes into play if it sees something wrong with what you're about to do. When an alcoholic thinks about drinking, your mind will block out what it did to you and only allow you to see what it's going to do for you. So why wouldn't you act on that? That's why the book says it's not a matter of choice. It's not a matter of willpower. Certain times we can't bring into our memory last week the suffering. And then we go into AA, conventional AA meetings, and we say stuff like, remember your last load, keep it green, play the tapes, don't believe the lie. Well, that all contradicts page 24. They can't both be right. You know what I mean? Somebody's wrong. One says the exact opposite of the other. I don't care which one you believe, but pick one. You know what I mean? They can't both be right. The tricky part about that is it says at certain times, which means maybe there's times I can kind of remember the pain a little bit to keep me sober. But if I remember it three times and the fourth time it kills me, was it really worth it? We sit in meetings going, oh, I felt like drinking, blah, 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 I'm here to talk about it. We clap for you. I would never clap for a person like that. You're killing them clapping for them. Give them a real answer. Try to help them. Explain this stuff to them. We tell them, oh, you got to pray, man. They don't know how to pray. Pray? To who? God? I don't think so. I've been hiding from God my whole life. If I pray to him, he'll know where I'm at. Doesn't sound like a good idea. No, thank you. So the problem with AA, as I see it, is the solution we have is not the solution you're looking for. No one comes in here. Spiritual remedy to our illness just doesn't look appealing. You know what I mean? Turn your will and life over to God, who you've been hiding from. Write a list of all the things that are blocking your resentment, fear. Bad enough, you know, I've been trying to keep that a secret my whole life. Tell somebody about it. And if that's not enough, let's go to these people and fix it. You know, it just doesn't look good. We need a new PR department in that area to sell this stuff. Because the answer we got is not the answer you're looking for, believe me. And that's why we struggle in AA. If the answer was simple and good like that, and I mean, it is simple, but it's not easy. There's a price to be paid. We got to get you out of your life. Destruction of self-centeredness. If we can get you out of your life, this is not a hard deal at all. The problem is I'm involved in it, and I block off the power any given moment. Step two, I never really had a problem with the whole higher power idea. God, personal God, like Bill says in his story, never thought of God as my friend, a loving God, but I'll give you, there is a God. Look, the longer I stay sober, I don't know that it's really that important in step two what your conception of God is, because it almost killed you. The sum total of all your intellectual knowledge almost killed you. So in the beginning, I hate to say it, but who asked you? My sponsor said, Chris, I don't really care about your opinion of the 12 steps. You should be dead or in jail, and I have an answer for you, so I don't want to hear you talk about wordy explanations of what you think of it. No one cares. You're an idiot. And he was right. I am an idiot to this day. I'm still an idiot. And I'm proud to at least finally understand and really mean that. When I say I'm an idiot, did I understand that? And I mean that. I'm not just saying that. Of myself, I'm nothing. The Father does the works. What the hell's nothing mean? That's pretty much idiot. Anything my mind gets into goes bad. So I went into step three with this attitude. What do I got to lose? I looked at it this way. And you're a bunch of gambling people, and here we got the Super Bowl going on. I know we like to say no major decisions in the first year. Well, you might die in AA then, because this is a pretty major decision on the wall behind me, step three, and it's supposed to be done shortly into here. It's a bet. I'm going to bet there is a God and take the rest of these steps and see what happens, or I'm going to bet there's no God and see what happens. I mean, the book's pretty clear cut. Keep drinking and report back to us, or accept spiritual help, right? There's no door number three. We don't have a plan. Hey, if you don't dig that for now, just go to meetings and hang out and just do this. Most of us get on that plan, but I'm here to tell you, you made it up. It's not out of our literature. I've been on it, so I can say that. There is no door number three in AA. It's take these 12 steps or die. What do you want to do? So I went into step three with that attitude. Hey, if there's not a God, the downside's kind of limited. Yeah, maybe I could have stole a couple times. Maybe, I don't know, cheated on my wife. I could have got away with some kind of behavior. You know what I mean? But if there is a God, I'm in trouble. So I'm going to bet there is and see what happens. And I went into step three with that attitude. Sam Shoemaker said, turn as much of yourself as you understand to as much of God as you understand. Anybody can do that, right? And step three has some vital information. It talks about my thinking being the problem, not drinking, right? If I said, why'd you drink? You'd say, because I didn't feel good. It made me feel better. Well, that's not a problem, is it? That's a solution, right? Your problem is, why didn't you feel good? Why'd you feel separate from the world? Why'd you feel blocked off, etc.? The problem is my thinking, not drinking at all. What a novel idea. I drank because I hated being sober. You think I'd have figured that out on my own? That's basically what AA teaches. Drinking's not your problem. Your problem is, apparently, you hate being sober. And that's what it is. I feel blocked off, separate from the world when I'm sober. Right? Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. There's a little line in the doctor's opinion that gets thrown away. It says, our alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. In the face of all the bad stuff I talked about, and I did in life, I still feel more normal, drunk and high, than I ever did sober. I'm socially awkward sober. I can't do it. I mean, Thanksgiving, with my family, it's them and me. And I just feel completely just full of fear. You name it. Plug a word in. I can't do sober. So if you understand what I'm saying, Alcoholics Anonymous says, if you come to AA and stop drinking, you're going to get worse. Right? You're going to get worse. Most people go, what? I mean, we sent him to detox. He's doing good now, right? No. No, not without a sponsor, not without this stuff. I mean, that's a novel concept that you could get worse, stone cold sober, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, building up time. A as if time means anything. I know we love to clap for each other and carry our coins and all that stuff. I don't get it. You know what I mean? Hey, look, you may have 30, 40 years sober and be really well-versed at this and be able to help people, or not. Not at all. The time means nothing. You know, I mean, I'd much rather send somebody to a new guy right out of rehab that's getting some big book training than to have them get the conventional mindset. You know what I mean? Put the plug in the jug and shut up and listen. Listen to what? You're not telling me nothing. Right? So this step three, this idea that my thinking is the problem. Am I convinced of that? Because if I'm not, there's no use turning my thinking, which is my will, over to something. If I think I could still use it. Talks about self will kill you. 100 forms of self. Talks about a new attitude towards God. He's the director. I'm just going to play my part. He's the principal. I'm his agent. I work for him. He's the father. I'm the child. All spiritual writings, it says the correct relationship between God and us human beings is that of a loving parent and a child. I don't remember hearing that in grade school or wherever I was learning. I thought of a guy's going to get you, writing down all the bad stuff I did. And then I started thinking about my father. And guess what? Every time I got in trouble in life, guess who I called? My dad. I was never embarrassed. I mean, I was embarrassed, but dad got the call. Somebody said to me, well, why don't you go to God like that? Wow. Makes too much sense, doesn't it? Why don't you, our father? Oh, he's not really my father. Then why are you saying the prayer? We love to read Ebbett Fox, who breaks down the Our Father, right? Just who was it? There was a Supreme Court justice years ago, Oliver Wendell Holmes. They interviewed him and they said, what are your religious beliefs? He said, my religious beliefs can be summed up in the first two words of the Lord's Prayer. If you understand that, you understand everything. Our Father makes us all related. I got bad news for you. Our Father, right? We're all God's kids. Why are we fighting with each other? Help each other out. Everybody's your brother and sister out there. And everything that implies under Our Father. And I really had to start thinking about that stuff and meditating on it. So meditation gets so slighted in AA. It's so important. If you read any of the AA history, it's all they talk about. It's quiet time in the morning, Oxford groups, meditation, meditation, meditation. AA, man, we give it like 2 seconds and we're gone. Relieve me of the bondage of self, not alcohol. Relieve me of the bondage of me. Apparently, they tell me if I can get my mind off me for 5 seconds, I'll be okay in life. But how do you do that? I've had a love affair with me for years. I can't walk by a mirror without stopping and talking to I mean, it ain't always good, don't get me wrong. But I'm attached to me. Bondage of self. Think about those words. And it's telling me, if God, take away my difficulties, and I'll try to tell other people about you. Because I can't do it when I'm caught up in me. And then it says, this is a great decision you made, but it means nothing unless you do a four-step immediately. I'm paraphrasing, but it says that in the big book. It'll have no effect on your life. That's why the whole working the first three steps deal, you're kidding yourself. Because you can't. If you don't do 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, don't even bother working the first three steps. It ain't going to have any effect on your life. And because there's things that are blocking you. In step four, we get them on paper. Three major areas of self, which block me off from God. Sin, they talk about defects. Anything that blocks me off from God and you people is a sin or a defect. Resentment, fear, sex conduct. They talk about what people, principles, institution. And I start writing them down. The reason you write them is you can only think about one resentment at a time in your head. So you'll sit there and you go, I don't really have that many. Because you can only think about one at a time. When you start writing them down, you go, Jesus Christ, I'm a loser. And then you get the fears and all harms done others. And it hits you with a certain impact. And I think it's designed to be that way. Look at it. Discuss it with my sponsor. Go through a fifth step with somebody that can be objective and give me clear-cut guidance. Basic instincts of life, where that was affected. Social instincts, security, sex. We all have the same three, and learning about that and how that ties into it. And then there's a little prayer or a little mental trick at the end. We're not asking you not to get resentful in life, not ever to get afraid again, or not ever to get lustful. That would be impossible. AA says you don't want to stay that way. When you get that way, spot it, time out, get undisturbed, say the prayer, move on. The resentment prayer is, this person is mentally, spiritually sick. I like to say spiritually handicapped. I like analogies, if you couldn't tell by now. A guy said to me once, if you went into a Wawa and a handicapped kid cut in front of you, what would you do? Nothing. What if some jerk from the neighborhood's kid cut in front of you? What's the difference? The difference is my mind assigns one is sick and I cut him a break and the other one should know better. And I don't even have to think about that. He said, why don't you do that with all people? Isn't everybody spiritually sick? I can see you are. I mean, he's looking at my fourth step, right? And I'm going, I'm spiritually sick, but you're so spiritually handicapped, right? I tried to fight with people, and I mean, everybody's blocked off. You start understanding this stuff, it just looks silly. Not that you won't get that way at times. You will. But and there's a part of the prayer that most of us miss. Yeah, grant me the patience and tolerance I would if they were really sick. Wink, wink. Right? And then the next part, which everybody misses, is how can I be helpful to this person? If I'm studying spiritual stuff for 17 years and I can't help the guy I don't like, then that's a shame on me because he doesn't know the person at work or in the Wawa, the dry cleaners on 95. It doesn't mean I pull people over and try to 12-step them, but where there's any good cause, it's more than just, oh, thank God I didn't act out, I didn't fight with them. Who the hell are you? Isn't that great? Did you try to help them, teach them this stuff? Maybe tell them you're in AA. That's where you're learning this stuff. Maybe give us a good plug once in a while so that the general public would get the hell, would know what the hell AA is all about. They don't know. You think these shows on TV explain it to them? These things I watch, they're ridiculous. They don't have a clue. Most of the people in AA don't have a clue. The general public doesn't have a clue. Professionals don't have a clue. Now, you might think, he's getting a little crazy here. That's my experience. They ain't learning this stuff. Trust me. It's all you. It's all setting it up and people, places, and things and your triggers and changing your behavior. It's nothing to do with the spiritual remedy we're talking about here. Fears come from relying on you. When you look at them on paper, they look silly. We all have the same ones, by the way. We all have the same resentments, different names. Aunt Mary, Uncle John. We all get the same ones. You know what I mean? I could write your fourth step for you. Mother, father, sister, brother, siblings, current job, current wife, etc., former job, we all get the same ones. This is not rocket science. That's why we know this stuff. Fears come from relying on you. The fear prayer is, God, direct my attention to what you would have me be. And the fear goes away. See, because I was taught, and the big book disciplines you to do this. I don't know how to pray. No kidding. That's what the 12 steps are for. They discipline you how to pray. Start with the third step, prayer on. Every prayer is I ask God for a favor, and then there's something on the back end, heavily weighted in his favor. Relieve me of the bondage of self, I'll do your will. Take away my difficulties, I'll tell other people about you. Don't let me fight with this person, I'll try to help them. Remove this fear, I'll try to help them. And all the prayers are like that. And I was taught if your prayer is not in God's best interest, it's a selfish prayer. You can say it, but it ain't going to do much for you. I spent my whole life doing that. Please bless me, bless my family and friends, help me in work, blah, blah, keep me sober. That's a good deal for me. Ain't nothing in it for God, is it? AA 101, right? Please, God, keep me sober. I'd like to know what's in it for God there. We have this idea that, well, God would want me to be sober. Why is that, Chris? I'd be a better husband. I'd be a better work employee, employer, whatever, right? Really? Do you mind if we call your family and check on that? No, that's all right. In other words, you're kidding yourself. And I'm sure God would want us all sober, according to that thinking. Then why isn't everybody sober? Because it takes more than that. He wants you to go to work for him. He wants to work through you to help others. Our Father. That's all he wants from you. He doesn't need your advice on running your life. All I ever gave him, right? That takes away all my prayers right there. He doesn't need your advice on running your life. He just wants you to get out of the way, and he's going to work through you to help the other kids. There's a novel concept. Steps 6 and 7. I'm getting a little familiar with I'm getting a little familiar with defects now. Step 6 says, are you ready to have God remove them? Yes. Really? Yeah, yeah. I don't think they want you to know this information at step 6. 15 years later, Bill writes in the 12 and 12, one little paragraph in the big book. Are you ready? Yeah, move on. I don't know if he meant it or not, but that's good to have limited information. 15 years later, he throws in, oh, by the way, this is the biggest step in AA. This is the biggest spiritual journey a human being can take. It didn't look like it. And you know why? It's in the details. The devil's in the details. I don't really want my defects removed. Maybe you do, really. How'd you like to be 100% lust free? What? No, I mean, I would like to do that, but what does that mean? Is that like no sex? Or I'll tell you what, I would like to make progress in that area. Right? It goes from completely removed to progress. Okay. How'd you like to be 100% anger free? Yeah, I mean, yeah, unjustified anger. I mean, I'm not going to be a sap. I ain't going to let people walk over me in business. Progress. How'd you like to be 100% gossip free? Well, sure. I mean, unless somebody in the meeting, we make fun of it. So I don't really want my defects removed. It's kind of like, how'd you like the federal deficit removed? Yeah. Okay, we're going to raise your taxes. Whoa! Right? You don't want the answer we got, like I'm telling you. We got an answer that will fix your life and will solve all your problems. Problem is, it ain't the answer you're looking for. It really would be the same answer as what's going on in the world now. But the problem is in the details. We don't want what the answer entails. Okay, step 7, humbly ask them to remove these defects. Had to learn about humility. It's different than humiliation or getting humiliated. Humility is the opposite of pride. Pride is the number one bat and lead off in the 7 deadly sins, so it's got to be pretty bad. There's not a good form of it that I'm aware of, self-pride. Maybe I can be proud of you or your kids or something. But anytime I'm proud of what I'm doing, it's a slippery slope. I can't see God's hand real quick, and it goes quickly. You know what I mean? People, you should take some pride. Okay, well, then how's it bat and lead off in the 7 deadly sins if I should be proud? And then they go, oh, yeah, well, I never thought about that. The opposite of pride, and pride, by the way, is an unjustified opinion of me. It's kind of what I want you to think of me, so it's what I show you. I might embellish a little bit or whatever goes along with that. Self-esteem is more what I think you think of me and is a little more accurate, but neither one of them. Humility is the opposite of them. Humility is putting God and everybody else in the world ahead of me. I bat last. I don't know about you. When I was growing up in Southwest Philly, my dad never sat me down and said, Chris, here's the secret to life. You put God and everybody else in front of you, and you bat last. I was taught, a man looks out for number one. You go to work to take care of your family. Blah, 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 blah. That's great in the material world. You might go far, but it'll kill you in AA. It'll kill you in the spiritual world. Just no room for it. When I'm proud, I can't see God's hand in anything. It's me. You know, I should run around. I should ride around with flyers about me in my trunk, handing them out to people. You know what I mean? That's the way I think. That's pride. Steps 8 and 9, a list of people I harm by living this way. I had to learn. Look, if I stole off your stuff like that, that's easy to see. The more subtle stuff like, I don't know how to act around people, family members. I walk in a room and their faces change. They go, oh, here he comes, you know what I mean? Hide your wallet. You know, I wonder if he's still sober, blah, blah, blah. And I go into a room and I go, these people, look, they suck. Look at them. And then all of a sudden I go through these 12 steps and it was pointed out to me how I do this. And I go in and I go, hi, how you doing? Hey, Uncle John, who I secretly can't stand. And all of a sudden they act completely different around me. And I go, oh, man, my family's great. Nothing changed but me, my perception. Sandy Beach, one of my favorite AA speakers, one of my mentors, says you can change the world one person at a time through these steps. Nothing really changed except my perception of the world. Nothing else changed. They didn't change, right? I just believe that people react to the energy you're giving off. If it's hostile, you're going to perceive the world as hostile. You go through these steps and have a more loving energy, all of a sudden the world's great. You start living this way, my childhood gets better the longer I stay sober. Wasn't that? I mean, it really does. It didn't change, but it does. They weren't that bad. And then my sponsor, direct amends, face-to-face, he was very anal with that. Wherever possible, not whenever you get around to it. It doesn't say whenever. That means time. Wherever means place. Wherever these people are, you go start fixing it. And see any talk. You know, amends are very dangerous. You don't do them on your own. Some should be made, some shouldn't, but they have to be addressed. And we came up with a plan. He taught me how to do it. Admit I was wrong. One thing. He said the words I'm sorry mean nothing coming from your lips. You are to say I was. So I remember Happy Days, any of you, Fonzie couldn't get it out. I was wrong, right? When you say you're wrong, all of a sudden people listen. Don't tell me he's starting to learn something. You go in and say, I'm sorry. They don't hear you. They close their ears right away. I was wrong. Could you forgive me? Is there anything else I did to hurt you? What can we do to make this right? Then you're allowed to negotiate a little bit after the fact. You're not the lead negotiator. I don't walk in going, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Bill. I stole 10 grand off you, so I'm going to give you 500 a month. No. You let Bill decide. Amends are about other people, letting them get healthy. We take everything selfishly, so I think amends are about me. They're really about getting the other person, amending the relationship. If you want to have a relationship with the big man, it says first fix your human relationships, or you can't have one. That's why many of us struggle in AA. We kind of get that it's vaguely about God or something, and I'm okay with that, but I really don't like people too much. These freaking idiots in the meeting and all. I'm okay with God. I just ain't real cool with people. And that's not going to work. He said, I think the big book says, if you got a gift, take it back, make your amends. Then it's probably like proving to them that you mean business. So apparently, if you want a relationship with the higher power, the big power, you got to fix your human relationships. There ain't no getting around it. And I don't think it's a coincidence the steps are numbered like that, that step 9 is before 11. I can tell you great stories from amends. I can tell you a couple of people that weren't real impressed that I was in AA. I had one guy offer... He hired me on the spot and offered to pay all my amends for me. He said, I don't want you looking over your shoulder if you work for me. Are you kidding me? And there was big numbers on there. And I'm not saying it's going to happen to you. I'm just saying it happened to me. I didn't take advantage of it, but the guy did hire me. And I told him I'd give him a 3-year contract. And I was with him for 7 years. And I never missed a day. And he eventually sold the company. I went out on my own. It's back on Wall Street. So don't be real happy for me. It's not all it's cracked up to be. As I said, I was spoiled years ago. I'm paying the price today. Oh, well, that's the way it is. Steps 10, 11, and 12. 10 is a formula to live by. I remember I was at a beginner's meeting, whatever that is, recently. I guess that's different than a veteran's meeting or something like that. I'm not really quite sure yet, but I remember this kid put his hand up and he said, wouldn't it be cool if there was just like a sheet in AA and it just said, do this, 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 and you'll be okay. There is. There's a whole book like that. We've got them numbered, right? For people like us. But we still can't figure it out. There really is, if you're new. There really is. And you can do it starting tonight. Matter of fact, they tell you to do it sooner rather than later. What's the one thing we can't give you? Willingness. What's the only thing you got to bring to the table? Willingness. When do you have the most willingness? When you're new. And then what do we tell people? Oh, relax. And that's why we never get people to this process. Once the ego comes back, you ain't getting to it. You might mean to. It's very difficult. Very difficult. Step 10 is a formula. When these things crop up, they're going to crop up for the rest of your life, defects. They don't go anywhere. We just show you what they look like. We teach you to... I'm used to looking for defects, so it's not a foreign concept. I'm just used to looking at for them in you. And this is telling me to turn them inward and spot them in me. And when I get resentful, put a word on it, right? Time out. Talk to God. Calm me down, right? Walk away. Go in the bathroom. Whatever you got to do. Get undisturbed, right? Get undisturbed is rule number one. Ask God to remove it. Talk to somebody about it if it's something big. Make amends if you already acted out. And here's another part we miss. Turn your thoughts away from yourself. It doesn't say turn inward. It doesn't say go to a meeting and share about it. When you talk about a problem, you make it bigger. The spiritual world says, ask God to forgive you, turn your back on it. It doesn't exist. Go try to help somebody. The only way I know to get my mind off me, which I said in the beginning is the problem, is to either think about you or to think about God. Otherwise, I'm thinking about me. And that ain't never good. There's some great promises in step 10. There's also a big warning that it's easy to get complacent. All human beings do. You'll be tempted to rest on your laurels. Don't do it. Keep moving on. Step 11, prayer and meditation, which a lot of us just give lip service to. As I said before, I had no idea how to pray unselfishly. Step 11 teaches me that from the morning all through the day and when you go to bed. I mean, you have another part of your day we're not aware of. I mean, it covers everything to direct your thinking when you get up in the morning on awakening, which implies you're a little sick. You might want to pray before you even get in the shower. You know, I may get in some trouble in the hallway, you know what I mean? So on awakening, come up with a plan for the day. Ask God to direct your thinking, et cetera, et cetera. When you get indecisive, you don't know what to do, ask for an intuitive thought or decision. It covers every possible scenario. At night, do this little recap. Do I owe an apology, et cetera, right? Ask God what corrective measures, et cetera. It covers everything. If you don't know how to pray, it's all in there in step 11. Pray for... show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. It just covers every possible scenario you might have in life. okay, and then meditation, which can be very simple or you can take it to different levels. A simple meditation for me is A, being quiet, no TV or radio, and just reading something spiritual or talking to somebody about something spiritual and pondering it and thinking about it. And what does this mean? And just running scenarios through my head. But that's, and the Oxford groups, which is where AA came from, I'm rereading a lot of their stuff, just this idea of being guided through life instead of having to manage your way through life. It's hard having to manage your life. It's a lot of work. By the end of the day, you get to a meeting, you're like, oh, man. And, you know, you start to get guided through life, and you're like, whoo, how's everything? Okay. I heard your wife left you. Yeah, I'm fine. Heard you lost your job. Yeah, it's good. You know, what? I'm gone. And you just seem to breeze through life. This guidance thing is really important. Get to know what they're talking about and check in with other people on it. And then, of course, step 12, which is the big wrap-up. I'm reading the wrong way. The big wrap-up, right? Which tells you, haven't had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, right? We tried to carry this message. I don't have a message. I'm a moron on my own. Don't follow me anywhere. I'll lead you into a ditch, right? This message, that's the message of AA. I've had a spiritual awakening by taking these other 11 steps. So I've been awakened to something spiritually. And I can show you how to do it. That's all. That's the only message of AA. There's only one. Oh, there's many ways to get sober as there are people in AA. That's not what that says. One common solution, this message. Everybody has a different spin on it, a different style maybe. But if you ain't using that information in the big book and this stuff, you're making up stuff. We tend to make up a lot of stuff in AA. And then the hard part, practice these principles in all your affairs. It's easy to be a hero in AA, everybody loves you, blah, 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 right? Try going home and doing it with my wife. Nice sunny day. Maybe I want to go golfing. And she goes, oh, we got to go to your niece's confirmation today. You know, I just want to, like Tiger Woods, and just chase her through the house with a 9-iron or something. Where does that come from, right? Or in work with the people I secretly can't stand and I feel smarter than, right? Act like I heard of AA in those scenarios. That's the hard part. At the dry cleaners, in the Wawa. Be of service. Man, please, if you're new, please, somehow, get to the literature, whatever that takes. Find your way through this minefield that we call AA. There's so many opinions and this and that, but it's really not that complicated. Find your way to the literature. Like Bill says, we beg of you. He's begging us 75 years ago to take these steps now. 75 years later, we're still going, well, you didn't really mean now. Sometime in the near future, right? Take it easy there, Bill. You see what I'm saying? It's such a minefield. You've got to somehow get to the literature. With technology, you can have the best speakers in AA all over the world at your disposal, in your car, studies, people breaking down the book for you. I mean, take advantage of that stuff. Somehow get to the literature, get somebody to show you how to do this stuff, and join us, like it says, as we trudge the road of happy destiny. Thank you.